We finished up last Sunday on verse 12, and I'd like to just share a few things in the verses 13 through 17 to begin with. And to summarize what is there, chapter 4, verses 13 through 17. And during this summary, too, I just want to mention that I've tried to dig a little deeper and see if I could find anything that would help resolve the problem that Jerry brought up last week, and that is basically whose son was Obed. Was it Boaz's or from to be attributed to the Elimelech-Mahlon line? And while I don't have a satisfactory answer, hopefully I can summarize in such a way as maybe sheds a little bit more light on the situation. In verse 13, we read that Ruth becomes Boaz's wife. And the Lord, it says, enabled her to conceive and to give birth to a son. Now this child is regarded as God's gift to Boaz, to Ruth, and as we'll see, as Naomi as well. In verse 12, we looked at last week, the men there also acknowledge the fact that this child that is to be born is a child that is given by the Lord himself. So the child to be understood is God's gift. And the fact that it was a son shows especially God's divine favor upon the couple. In verse 14, the women also acknowledge this child is God's gift. And they acknowledge, too, that the Lord has given Naomi this blessing. The child is regarded as something of a miracle. And in the Midrash, which is a Jewish book of learning that was somewhat of a commentary on the Law and the Prophets, there, it explains the birth as a miracle in that text. And it basically looks at Ruth as being given a new womb, as it were, a womb by divine intervention that was able to conceive a son through the elderly Boaz, where she was unable to do so through Mahlon. So what you see here, and those who have interpreted this text, again, behind here you see God's divine working. God has blessed them. What is to be understood is that God is the principal participant in this action, not Ruth and Boaz. He is the one who is bringing to pass his will. Now in verses 14 through 15 as well, thanksgiving is expressed because God has not left Naomi without a kinsman redeemer. And at this point, the kinsman redeemer in view is not Boaz, it's the child. And we see this in verse 15 as we see the end of this argument, where in 15 at the end it says, Ruth has given birth to him. To who? The kinsman redeemer. So now, with the birth of the child, the responsibilities of the kinsman redeemer now are passed on to this child. The women pray that the child will become famous. And the term there is the same that was used in the blessing that the men gave at the gate to Boaz, that he would become wealthy and successful. The same idea. And that he would become to Naomi, literally, a life restorer. One who would nourish her in her old age. What we see here is that the women are foreseeing, in a sense they're almost prophesying, as it were, the hope for Naomi's future. In this child, who is now the one to whom the Elimelech-Mahlon inheritance will go to. And the responsibility for caring for Naomi and Ruth now really passes on to this child. Now, it's also interesting to just note, remember when Naomi returns, and we see in chapter 1, verse 19, all the women could say was, whoa, is this Naomi? And nothing more. And they were silent. And what they listened to was Naomi's complaint. But here in chapter 4, they break out in praise and thanksgiving for the visible blessing that is now upon Naomi. And I also mentioned back in chapter 1, verse 16 and 17, that blessing of God was already in its making with Ruth's decision to return with Naomi and to make Naomi's God her God. To make her people, Naomi's people, her people. The blessing was invisible at that time, but God was in the midst of working that blessing out, and now it becomes visible. And praise and thanksgiving breaks forth from those women who stood amazed at the appearance of Naomi when she first returned. The tribute to God's grace and God's providential working. We also see here a tribute to Ruth and Ruth's love for Naomi. And it is striking, the tribute that's given. A daughter-in-law, not just a daughter, but a daughter-in-law is said to be better to Naomi than seven sons. And sons were signs of divine favor. Now, I cannot sort of illustrate this for the Middle East and for Israel, but I know when we lived in India, it was so clear that women were trouble. They were not a sign of blessing. In fact, in many ways, they were viewed as a cursing. I remember when Julie and I took Nisha to the home of an Indian family, and this woman had three daughters and a son. And the three daughters happened to be there when we were having dinner with them. And when they found out that we had adopted Nisha, the first words out of this mother's mouth were, "Why a girl? If you had a choice, and if you're in your right mind, I mean, why would you choose a girl when you could have had a boy?" Julie and I didn't know how to respond. And her daughters are right there. And she said, "Well, girls are pain. They're trouble." And one of the reasons there is because they're an economical factor within the marriage, within the family. That is, that dowries have to be paid to have these young girls married, and large dowries, and they will go into debt to get their children married, their daughters married. And in the case, in the two cases that I knew firsthand, where there was four girls in one family, one boy, in this family, three girls and one boy, they pour all their money into this one boy. Everything goes to this son. And let me tell you, I met the son of one of these families, and he was one of the most spoiled, arrogant individuals I have ever met. I'm sorry to say that, but he was. But what they're doing, and I know this is going to sound crass, but they're building a pedigree so that this son can reap a large endowment. And they use that then to pay off the marrying off of their daughter. That, maybe in the Middle East, it wasn't that extreme. But what I'm trying to communicate here is for them to say that Ruth was better than seven sons was a remarkable statement. Probably the best way that this has been put that I have found, and here I've got to find it, here it is by Edward Campbell, and his commentary comes out of the Anchor Bible series, and he makes the statement in relationship to this tribute that Ruth is spoken of as worth seven times what the story has made such an absorbing concern, a son to be born. Let me say that again. Ruth is spoken of as worth seven times what the story all along has made such an absorbing concern, a son. It is a striking tribute to Ruth and her love and the role that she plays within the story. Now, Naomi likely expected a lonely old age when she left Moab, but now all is made new. Thanks to Ruth and her decision to go with Naomi, Naomi again has a family. And it says, Naomi, the women declare, has a son. She comes back empty, but she really didn't come back empty, as I shared some weeks ago. Already, God was filling her plate. And here it became visible. Now, just briefly here, I want to just talk about this problem of whose son now is this child. Is it Boaz's or Elimelech and Mahlon's? The law of the kinsman appears to view the child, the law of the kinsman redeemer, as belonging to the deceased. But in verse 12 of chapter 4, in verse 21, the child is spoken of as belonging to Boaz. So what's the problem here? First, let me just a few comments. First, the situation here is different from the typical kinsman marriage scenario. That is, unlike a brother who is the principal one to redeem the widow, a near kin, not a brother, does not appear obligated to do so, but has the first right after the brother to redeem. So it's a different situation, and therefore, the problem of a dual paternity or dual parenting would not exist in the same way if it had been a brother. Secondly, the purpose as expressed in verse 10 is to maintain the name of the dead and his property. So, to maintain the name of the dead with his property, verse 10. That is, that the name will not disappear from the family, and in the NIV, if you have it there, and it says the town records, it's really the gate of the city. They weren't records. That his name would not disappear from the city gate, from the community, as it were. This is fulfilled in Obed. In Obed, Elimelech and Mahlon are kept alive in the minds of the people, and the property in the family of Elimelech. The property does not belong to Boaz. So this is fulfilled. Now note also that Boaz was the primary goel of Elimelech, the primary redeemer. Thus, he should have married Naomi. But the problem is Naomi could not bear children. So Ruth becomes a substitute for Naomi. And in this sense, the child is Naomi. And that's what the women recognize. A son has been born to Naomi. Ruth's son is viewed, in other words, as Naomi's descendant. Now, let me summarize here. The union of Ruth and Boaz is reckoned to both of them now. Okay? It suggests that the marriage resulted in a dual paternity. There is a problem there. The name of Mahlon is kept within the community, though, through Obed. And the property legally is retained within the family of Elimelech and Mahlon. But the genealogical seed, and the one who really brought this to my attention last week was Bob Botten. And it seems to hold out that the genealogical seed is retained by Boaz. That the kinsman redeemer is fulfilled in that the name does not disappear from the city gate, is retained in Obed, and the property legally is retained by the son as well. But the genealogical seed is retained by Boaz. Biologically, as it were, the child becomes Boaz. Now, any questions at this point? It doesn't sort of resolve it, but what I'm trying to do is add a little bit more light. I felt compelled to do that because I didn't have too good of an answer last week, and that's because nobody seems to have a real clear-cut answer. Does that help at all, Jerry? Okay. It doesn't solve it. Now, what I'd like to do before we go into the genealogy in 18 through 22, I want to talk for a moment about the New Testament application of what we have here, particularly the kinsman redeemer law. Now, there is no place in the New Testament that specifically picks this theme up, that states that Jesus Christ is our kinsman redeemer. And so in that sense, it is not strictly a type, that the kinsman redeemer is not strictly a type of Jesus. But it seems to be implied. I think we can go that far. 13 times in the book of Isaiah, the Messiah is spoken of as our Goel, our Redeemer. And in the New Testament, of course, Jesus is spoken of as our Redeemer. A couple observations here. Note the redemption of Naomi and Ruth and the Elimelech-Mahlon line came about in an unforeseen an unusual way. So also, through this little story, the redemption of Israel comes about in an unusual way. That is through the seed of Boaz and Ruth. Remember, this takes place in the time of the judges. It's a time of lawlessness. It's a time marked by sin. It's a time where the people have forgotten their God. And the principal individual who brings Israel back to their God is David, a man after God's own heart. And so not only are the principal figures in the book of Ruth redeemed, but in time, the whole nation is redeemed through this kinsman redeemer act. And then we project and come to the New Testament, and we too are redeemed through a similar sort of act. One of my favorite passages in the scripture is found in Hebrews chapter 2. And I'm going to begin this, but I'd like us to join in with me in passages that depict how it is that Jesus himself plays in a very sort of unique way the role of kinsman redeemer on our part. In chapter 2 of Hebrews, starting in verse 14, we read, "Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason he had to be made like his brother in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people." And coupled with that, and this was read earlier this morning in Galatians 4, verse 4, "But when the time had fully come, God sent his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive the full rights of sons." Jesus took on humanity in order that he might play the role, as it were, of the kinsman redeemer on our behalf. He becomes one with us, and he takes us, as it were, unto himself as brothers. And through fulfilling the work of redemption on our behalf, we now receive the full rights of sonship. We inherit, even as Bill brought out earlier this morning, we inherit the inheritance of the Redeemer, Christ himself. In Corinthians, it speaks that we have received all things, and all things belong to Christ, and they belong to God. This little story of Ruth has implications that go far beyond just the events that are narrated in the book. It is a beautiful picture of what Christ has done for us. And if one would look at what Boaz did as a sacrifice, how much more was it a sacrifice for Christ? For he, as it were, emptied himself, or he did empty himself. What he gave up is something we cannot fathom. He became one with us. He becomes, and it's so hard for me to say this, but because the writer of Hebrews says, I can say, he becomes our brother. And as a brother, from the inside, within the family of humanity, he redeems us. Now, what I'd like to do is, for just a little time here, what other passages come to your mind that speak of Christ as our Redeemer? In the New Testament, there are quite a few. But anything else that highlights or illustrates this? Did everybody hear that? No. You want me to? It's great. She spoke about, Jane brought up the idea of us being clothed in the righteousness of Christ. And she brought it right back to chapter 3 in Ruth, where Ruth says, you know, that you're a kinsman redeemer. Spread your garment over me. basically saying, marry me, clothe me, take me in. And Christ has done so for us as our kinsman redeemer. He has clothed us with his righteousness. He has married us. That's another theme within the scriptures, the bride and the bridegroom. Thank you, James. I mean, to project the image, I think at one point we were at the feet of Jesus. And rather than us initiating as Ruth, we didn't initiate. But Christ came on his own initiative and closed it. I think of Ezekiel 16, where it talks about Israel as an unwanted baby that's been born and thrown out into the field, and God comes upon this child who, it says, is squirming in its blood. He bends down and he says, live. We didn't initiate, he did. And in our blood, as it were, he came and he redeemed us. He said, live. Bill. Care to comment a little bit more on that, Bill? Okay. Okay. Thank you. Ties in, I might just say, Bill, to the fact that the nearest of kin forfeited his right, or gave his right over to Boaz because of what it would do to his own inheritance. He was concerned about that. And Boaz, whether there was reason to be concerned or not, he didn't allow that to stop him. Even so, Christ did not stop Christ. David. Go for it. You know, even before the cross, there's the emptying process that Paul speaks of in Philippians 2. And I don't know, maybe I can put a plug in for Jerry's book. I haven't read it, but I can't imagine, because of the content of the material, that he speaks of what that emptying process, to a certain extent, meant for Christ. Would I be fair in saying that, Jerry? And I think sometimes we so focus on the cross that we forget of the sacrifice that began in heaven and transpire between, you know, heaven and earth. So we're speaking of something much bigger than just the cross. Is someone else? Bill. No. the best that they've been able to do, it appears its earliest position is not connected, but joined to Judges. As a result, some have felt it was sort of an appendix to the book of Judges. But sometime within there, it becomes part of what's called the Megillot, which is the five scrolls that were each one. There were five small books that were read at different Jewish feasts. So its history goes back quite a long way, and I don't think there's any really way of reconstructing, when that took place. The writing of it, most people, even Edward Campbell, who I would have thought would have maybe pushed a later date, he believes that it was written within the first monarchy. That would be before the division between the North and the South. So either at the end of David's life or in the reign of Solomon. So it was written fairly early. It had to be written no earlier than David because of the genealogy where David's included, or even verse 17 before the Okay, we have a few minutes left, and I want to come back. I asked a question in the very first class, and I'm going to ask it again now that we've gone through the book. What's the theme of Ruth? What is the underlying theme of this book? There were several things suggested at that time. Now that we've studied it, we need to test our theories, as it were. What is the theme of Ruth? And I think the word bad choices as opposed to sin is the best way of putting it here, because I cannot say definitively that they sinned in leaving the land of Israel and coming to Moab, but it clearly, in light of God's covenant with the people, it was a very unwise decision, because God promised blessing in the land for obedience. And certainly during the period of Judges, the things that happened to him were God's judgment and discipline upon the nation for their disobedience. And he withdrawn that blessing and that fruitfulness from the land. And therefore to move down into Moab to seek the blessing was to move out of, in a sense, God's covenant, the realm of God's covenant blessing. So I would say, yes, it was unwise. And therefore, yes, an unwise decision. God does wonders. Zelda. Hand over here. So, at this point, the two that have shared, what we're seeing is that the underlying theme is not Ruth, is not the kinsman redeemer, it's not Boaz, it's not Naomi's, her life, but it's God behind the scenes, as it were, unseen, working out, what pleases him. Are we comfortable with that? Maybe I should say it this way. Is there anyone who's uncomfortable with that? Well, I'd have to agree with what's been shared myself. That is that the overall theme of the book is the trustworthiness and the providential working. And when we say providence, we're talking about usually God's unforeseen working out of his purpose. Rather than direct intervention like miracles and such things, God as it were, as a conductor who's orchestrating the affairs of mankind, moving them towards the accomplishment of what he has determined in purpose. And he's doing that even now and will so to the end of time. But he's here, not in the big picture only, but in the small picture. And as Jerry said, not just in the good things that we do, but in the mistakes that we make, and even the sin that we commit. Now, the sovereign working again, is that the offspring, the fruit again of Boaz and Ruth does not impact just the immediate situation. God's purposes in his working are not just micro, but macro. And we've seen it that it goes beyond just Ruth and Boaz and Naomi, but it goes to the nation. And that's one of the reasons when we come to the genealogy that's there. You know, you ask the question, why does the genealogy come at the end of the book, which is really sort of uncommon? It's because it does show that this scenario, this working of God in this particular situation, had a rippling effect for the whole nation. That the fruit of Ruth and Boaz, the fruit of righteousness, that righteous offspring, blessed the whole nation and delivered them from the ignorance and the blindness and the lawlessness of one of the darkest periods in Israel's history. God raised up David to lead them. And I want a quote here that seems to sum this up well. It came from some of my reading. Speaking of the trustworthiness of God in the book of Ruth, it says, Yahweh saw to his people's needs. In chapter 1, verse 6, where it says God had visited his people again, and there was food again in Israel. That God has been kept before us in a series of greetings. When Boaz comes up, the Lord be with you and also with you. In a series, not only greetings, but prayers and blessings throughout the scenes that took place within Bethlehem, and has been at work from the shadows in various chance encounters, as he put it, of the key figures. First, and in verses 13 and 14, first the narrator himself, and then the chorus of women and men make him directly responsible for the fact that Naomi, and with her Ruth, had their needed redeemer. Valorous people and praiseworthy God, their living is thoroughly intertwined. Let me say that again. Valorous people and a praiseworthy God, their living is thoroughly intertwined. The book is a book predominantly about human affairs, what takes place. But what we see is that God, even in some of the most mundane things, is intertwined within those. Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age, says Jesus. It speaks hope to us today. Let us pray. Father, thank you so much for your word that is a constant reminder not only of who you are, but your commitment to be all that you are to us in any given moment of our lives. And Father, so much of that we do not see. It is so easy to give thanks and to praise you for the blessings that you're seeing. Father, we pray that by your grace, our faith may increase, that daily we might give you praise and thanksgiving for the blessings which are unseen. For you are that hidden one, in the shadows as it were, constantly working into us your good and divine purposes. And for this we give you thanks and acknowledge it before all principalities and powers this morning. Amen.